good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, well, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls because we have a very, very special guest this evening. And if we have any time at the end of the program, we'll invite your calls. But please hold your calls unless we specifically ask for them. Recently, the 911 Commission report was published, and it was a bestseller. Everybody was reading that report to try to find out what really happened on September 11th. How could this incredible thing have happened, and nobody was responsible? It was the process, we're told. Oh, it was the process. It was the FBI couldn't talk, agents couldn't talk to one another. It was the process. They were responsible. Nobody was fired. Nobody was held responsible. But the interesting thing, if you go into the opening pages of the 911 Commission report, you find that the president opposed the formation of the commission, saying he was afraid it would become political, it would be used in the upcoming elections, and we had to have a fight on terrorism. We were fighting terrorism. We couldn't waste time finding out what really happened on 911. And then suddenly the president reversed his position and said, oh, no, we'll have the commission, but I'll appoint the president of the commission, and I will make sure who's on the commission, and I will set out the rules for the commission. And of course, what happened was that you had a setup, a commission that was appointed not to address the issues of what really happened on September 11th. And there's so many questions we could raise, but I'm going to let our special guest this evening, Dave Von Kleist, raise a lot of those questions with you when I promise that you will never look at the world quite the same way after hearing the program this evening. Dave, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
So let's get on and tell us about this new video or DVD you put out called In Plain Sight.
Well, we called it In Plain Sight because this video focuses specifically on video footage and photographic evidence, and only video footage and photographic evidence. We take a look at what we saw on September 11th, and in some cases what we didn't see, and we ask questions. And that's basically it. Now, some folks are absolutely shocked from what they see, and they're more terrified of these questions than anything that we've heard, because the questions, just the fact that they're being asked, cast a very serious shadow of doubt, not just on who we are as a country, but what we have become as a country. I do want to give credit where credit is due. The director of the film, his name is William Lewis. He did the bulk of the work on this. He was the editor, put the whole thing together. Basically, I stood in front of the camera, addressed the issues, asked the questions, and helped to assemble the footage, but he did a lot of the work. And the inspiration was from a website which our attention was drawn to back in April. And I'd like to give that website. It is letsroll911.org. Now, the webmaster is Philip Jahan, and his website was raising some very serious questions, because what he showed on his website was something that I'm sure we've all seen, but we never really examined. And that, of course, was the footage of the plane hitting the South Tower. And on his website, he had a little video clip that showed, apparently, there was something attached to the belly of the plane, and just before it plowed into the building, there was a bright flash. Now, when I first saw this, and I thought that this has to be manipulated, because I'd never seen this and had never really heard about this before. Heard something about it, but never paid any attention to it. So what I did is I went and I got my DVD, that I had purchased at the supermarket checkout shortly after September 11th that was released by CNN, and some of you listening might have this. It's entitled America Remembers. Now, it's 7 minutes and 35 seconds into the first chapter of this DVD. You will see this clip. And that's what I did. I put it on and slowed it down, and sure enough, it was exactly as what I had seen at Phil Jahan's website, letsroll911.org. There was something attached to the belly of the plane, and there was a bright flash. So this is why we started investigating all of the other footage that we had. And Dr. Monteith, you know Joyce and I have been co-hosting a radio broadcast on the Genesis Network for over 4 years now. And we were live on September 11th. And the first thing we did when we went on air, it was straight up 9 o'clock Eastern Time. And the first thing we did was ask our listeners to please immediately, before we even say good morning, get a blank tape in your VCR and start taping any network you can. And that's what they did. And shortly after that, many of our listeners sent us VCR tapes, and luckily we had a lot of different network clips to go through to be able to assemble this video presentation called 911 in Plain Sight. It's even shocking for me to discuss this after putting this thing together, because the simple fact that we should have to ask a question, what is attached to the belly of this plane, is terrifying. Now, you've seen the video documentary, have you not, Dr.?
I certainly have, and I'll have to admit I was very impressed by it. And I'd seen the website, Let's Roll on 911, and, you know, I was very, very skeptical of that. So after seeing your video and the fact that you had these pictures not from one angle but from many angles, and they all showed the same thing, which gives far more credence to this. I mean, my initial impression was, well, that's got to be a reflection of some sort. It's not real. But you pick up the story, because I'm convinced that it is real.
Well, as the plane barreled into the building, and again, we called this in plain sight because so many people have this footage. As I mentioned, many people were videotaping on September 11th, and if the listeners out there were videotaping, I ask you folks out there, grab your videotape and put it into your machine, and fast forward or rewind, whatever you have to do, until you find that one clip we've all seen over and over again. And it shows the tower, the South Tower, and picture in your mind, if you will, a plane flying over your left shoulder, and you look up to see the belly of the plane, and the plane just slams into the tower and explodes. Now, we've all seen that clip.
Over and over and over again.
Yes, we have. And then they stopped showing it. After about a month, George Bush was on TV saying something to the effect of, America needs time to heal, and we can't be showing these clips of the attacks on America no more because it hurts too much and we have to move forward. I mean, when I hear that, I understand now why they didn't want to show these clips anymore. And again, if the folks out there can grab their videotapes, or maybe they have a copy of this DVD, you will find the clip and you will see that there was something. We don't know what. A pod of some sort. Some people are calling it a pod. Some folks call it a torpedo. Some folks say it's like a missile. Either way, no matter how you slice it, there is something big attached to the belly of this plane.
And you do not see this on ordinary planes. This is something you would never see on an ordinary plane. So this was not an ordinary plane, obviously.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you take a look at any plane, if any of you have been to an airport, look at the belly of these planes. Look at them as they take off and land. When the landing gear retracts, the bottom of those planes is absolutely smooth. Granted, there's a little bit of a bulge in the undercarriage where the wings are attaching to the fuselage, but for the most part, the bottom of those planes is as smooth as a baby's bottom. There is not something big attached to these. So here is the $10,000 question. If there was something attached to the belly of the plane that slammed into the South Tower, could that plane have taken off from Logan International Airport, a commercial airport, and not be noticed? Surely it would have been noticed. There were baggage handlers, food service personnel, fuel refuelers, crew members, passengers. Something this big, we're talking, I would have to estimate 12 to 16 feet. Wouldn't you agree? I mean,
yes, I would.
Okay. I mean, a big thing. this surely would have been noticed. So if it was not noticed, we now have to ask the question, where did this plane take off from? Could it have taken off from a private airfield? I think that that's doubtful, because not many private airfields are big enough to handle a 767 type of an aircraft. So the only other logical conclusion that we can come to is that it had to have taken off from some military airport. Now, I know this is shocking, but when you couple into that the testimony that was given by an eyewitness who was a Fox employee, his name was John Birnbach, and I did have a chance to talk with him a couple of days ago, and he's sticking to his story, because what he said when he called in on the Fox News Network on September 11th basically described something that could not be a private commercial aircraft. If I may indulge you, I have a clip ready. Can I play it for you, Stan?
Go right ahead. Okay. You do actually hear this on the video. Go ahead.
Yes, here it is.
Birnbach, a Fox employee, is on the phone with us. Mark witnessed this from what we understand. Mark, were you close enough to be able to see any markings on the airplane?
Hi, gentlemen. How you doing? Yeah, there was definitely a blue logo. It was like a circular logo on the front of the plane, towards the front. It definitely did not look like a commercial plane. I didn't see any windows on the sides.
Mark, if what you say is true, those could be cargo planes or something like that. You said you didn't see any windows in the side?
I didn't see any windows in the sides. I saw the plane flying low. I was probably like a block away from the subway in Brooklyn, and that plane came down very low. And again, it was not a normal flight that I've ever seen at an airport. It was a plane that had a blue logo on the front, and it did not look like it belonged in this area, to be frankly right about it. I mean, that's not an accident.
And that was, of course, broadcast on the very day that the attack, right?
Exactly right. And he was reporting shortly after the plane hit the second tower. Now, there are a couple of things in that testimony that we have to pay close attention to. First of all, he said the plane had a blue logo, a circular blue logo in the front of the plane. Well, we've been told that it was United Airliner Flight 175, a 767, that had hit the South Tower. United Airlines does have a logo on their plane, but it's not anywhere near the front. It's on the tail. And their logo is red and blue. And it has two U's superimposed over one another. We've all seen the United Airlines logo. So it'd be very difficult to mistake a circular blue logo on the front of the plane with a United Airlines logo on the tail. Second of all, Mr. Birnbach states that he, not once but twice, that there were no windows on this plane. He said there were definitely no windows on this plane. So with those two pieces of information, and the simple fact that it appeared, it was, you can't even argue that there's something attached to the belly of this plane.
Because you'll actually see it when you see the video, right?
Absolutely. And you can see it if you've got a magazine from September 11th. Many of the magazines have still photos of this very plane just before it hits the tower. Look at the photo. You can see that there's something attached to the belly of the plane that should not be there. It's been right there in plain sight all this time. So we started to put two and two together, said, okay, well, look, if the plane could not have taken off from a commercial airport, if the plane was likely to have taken off from a military airport because there was something big attached to the belly of it, you couple that with the testimony from Mark Birnbach saying the plane had no windows, we decided to do a little searching around to see if we could find an airliner-type craft that would fit the description of a 767 that would have no windows. Well, lo and behold, you can do a search on the Internet. If you do a search for Boeing 767 tanker transport, you will come up with a photograph of that exact plane, a 767 tanker transport that's been manufactured for the United States Air Force, and this plane has no windows.
Does it have a pod on the bottom of it?
No, not this one, but those things can be mounted at any time to any plane that they want to. Believe me, if we are dealing what we now believe we're dealing with, we're talking about an unlimited budget black operation.
All right, and of course, the other interesting thing about your pictures were this flash that, of course, as the plane is just about to hit the plane, the building, there's a flash, and it's not just on one picture. You actually have four different views of that from shot from four different angles, and there's always a flash just before the plane hits the building.
That is correct. And in this one particular instance, the plane that hit the South Tower, we were told, was Flight 175. There is a flash to the right of the fuselage just as the plane is about to plow into the building. And it is captured not by one, but by four different cameras.
From four different angles.
That is correct. Now we have to ask the question, what does an attachment to the belly of a plane and a flash that occurs before the plane slams into the building, what do either one of these events have to do with a simple terrorist hijacking? And I think we can all answer that it's obviously nothing. So the entire issue about a terrorist with a utility knife hijacking a plane has to be a rabbit trail. That means the entire war on freedom, war on terror, well, they're both one and the same. The whole war on terror is likely to be a sham.
Now, what about, of course, the first plane that hit the North Tower? That
mm-hmm.
was American Flight 11.
Right.
What did you notice when you slowed that picture down?
Well, we went to the Naudé brothers' footage. Of course, the Naudé brothers were the French videographers that were preparing a documentary about the New York City firefighters. And they just happened to be on the streets of New York during the time that the first plane, Flight 11, or as it was reported, Flight 11, flew right overhead. The camera panned up and to the left just in time to catch the plane slamming into the North Tower.
You know, Dave, I've often wondered, you know, when you're ordinarily, if you've ever done video footage, and I've done video filming, and you're filming something, you very seldom leave your target of what you're filming because you hear a plane fly overhead. That was either the greatest bit of luck of all time or... Well, what do you think about that?
Well, I believe it to be luck. I grew up in New York City, and those trade centers, I mean, I watched those go up back in the 60s. I used to walk down 7th Avenue when I was going to school, and I would watch those skyscrapers inch their way higher into the sky. And you can pretty much see them. All of the avenues run north and south in New York, and you can almost see the trade centers from just about anywhere in New York as long as you nail one of the avenues. And the other thing is that the airspace over Manhattan and the city like that is never, ever occupied with airliners. So whenever something big like that flies over, and if you've seen the clip and you've heard the audio track and you can hear that plane fly directly overhead, everybody would look up. I mean, because it's not something that happens. So I'm not surprised. I do believe that just happened to be a stroke of luck, if you can call it that, that they captured this on camera. But the clip itself, I mean, obviously we've seen that clip too, and the plane was too far away to see whether or not there was something attached to the belly of that plane. However, just before that plane hits, there is irrefutably a flash before it hits the building.
And you did see that by slowing it down. You won't see that if you just look at the regular clip, but you actually did it frame by frame, didn't you?
That's right. And you're right. You won't see it unless you know what you're looking for. Once you know it's there, if it's played in real time, you'll see it because it happens in the blink of an eye, but it's there. So what we did is we took that footage and slowed it down and examined it. And we zoomed in on it, and as the plane approaches the tower, you can see the shadow start to inch its way up the tower, and we all know when the shadow and the plane meet, that's the point of impact. But before they meet, a bright flash occurs, again, consistent with what happened with the South Tower.
And so there are some serious questions that are suddenly arising in the mind, and you can actually see it on the film footage that was shot that day. But you will never see it more vividly than in this picture in the video that, in plain sight. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two with our special guest, Dave Van Kleist, and tell you more about this incredible, incredible story. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dave Van Kleist, and we're talking about the new video that they put out where they've actually taken the film footage that was shot on the morning of September 11th and simply analyzed this very, very carefully. And for a time, why we were seeing the film footage over and over again, and now we just don't see that film footage much anymore. But there is a CD that is still available, that one that was put out by CNN.
Yes, there is. It's entitled America Remembers, and you can get it online by going to Amazon.com. You can also pick one up at Borders bookstores. I'm not here to promote Borders, but last week I happened to be going through Kansas City, and right off of the highway was a Borders bookstore, and so I peeled off the highway just to see, and sure enough, they had one there. So I picked up an extra copy.
Okay. All right, fine. Well, it's an amazing story, and of course, there's so much more here. And so let's, we've lost some of our stations. I'll be back with us in just a moment or two. But do you want to develop anything else here, or shall we go to Flight, 77, going into the Pentagon?
Well, we're sort of doing this a little bit backwards.
All right.
What I usually start with is talking about the Pentagon, because that's the controversy that's been around longer. But before we go there, I do want to finish up with this issue about the planes hitting the towers, because this is the centerpiece issue. The simple fact that we have to ask these questions: where did these planes come from, and why is there an attachment to the belly of the plane that we could see on Flight 175, or what we thought was Flight 175, and the flash that was captured from four different angles. Now, you'd mentioned earlier that when you first saw it, you thought maybe it could be a reflection. Well, there are two very good reasons why this cannot be a reflection. The first reason is because a reflection can only be seen from one angle at one time. We have four different angles, four different shots of this occurrence, and the flash is on every single one of them. So that's one reason why it can't be a reflection. The other reason it can't be a reflection is that side of the building was in the shade, so it couldn't be a reflection. And on one of the frames, you can actually see a reflection of the flash in the fuselage of the plane. The flash occurred somewhere between, and I'm just estimating, between like, say, 6 and 10 feet to the right of the fuselage as the plane was about to make contact or making contact with the tower. Would you agree with that estimation? It's somewhere in that area.
Well, I'll take your word for it. I didn't analyze that.
Okay, well, believe me, we went over this over and over and over again because we were astonished at what we were seeing. Because, ladies and gentlemen, what this video footage proves, above everything else, is that it could not have been terrorists hijacking the planes. Now, remember that 12 days after the September 11th attacks, Condoleezza Rice made the following statement. She said that we have definitive proof that links Osama bin Laden and the Taliban to the terrorist attacks of September 11th, and that we will release this information in due time. And to this day, they have never released any information that linked Osama or the Taliban definitively to the attacks of September 11th. So by definition, a conspiracy theory is a theory because there is no evidence.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment, but right now we're going to wait and we're going to bring the rest of our stations back online here with us, and then we'll develop this incredible story. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is not a nice thing to think about. And yet, of course, over there in Russia, well, I think most people certainly acknowledge that the bombings of the apartment houses in Moscow supposedly attributed to the Chechens, really, of course, was a KGB operation that justified the Soviet war with Chechnya, which has been a long and bloody and a terrible war with just devastation of the population there, the civilian population. But of course, it's been a wonderful diversion to keep the Russian people from realizing what's going on at home as they begin moving back into a police state. And yet, of course, the justification for the attack, the Russian attack on Chechnya, was supposedly the bombing of the apartment houses in Moscow, which now it appears, and you can look this up on the Internet, and I'm sure you can find references to the fact that most people believe there was a KGB operation to justify the war in Chechnya. So pick up the story there.
Okay, well, what basically we're talking about is the burning of the Reichstag revisited.
Right.
I mean, this is something that has gone on numerous times in history, and what you're bringing up in Chechnya is evidently happening here in the United States.
In fact, if anybody doubts that our leaders would hesitate to kill large numbers of people to justify foreign policy, Operation Northwood, it's covered. We actually have copies of that in our Iraq, the Untold Story syllabus. And this was previously a top secret government document going back to 1962 when they were planning on creating an incident, killing a lot of people, creating an incident to go justify going to war with Fidel Castro. It has been declassified, and you can pull it down off the Internet. You can get it from us, Operation Northwood. They didn't care how many people they killed. This was the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as long as they could justify going to war, but they had to have an incident. Operation Northwood, in James Bamford's book, Body of Secrets, avail, or you can get the report on the Internet, or, of course, you can get it in our syllabus. It's about a 30-page report. They were even going to blow up one of the rockets going up with John Glenn and kill him and blame it on Fidel Castro to justify going to war. It's incredible when you're dealing with evil people. The evil they'll go to. So pick up the story from there, Dave.
Well, yes, and I think it's very important because I know that there are listeners out there saying, oh, come on, this is all conspiracy theory, wacko, nutcase, fruitcake, conspiracy theory. I think that we all need to just take a quick look at the term conspiracy theory because we've all been conditioned to associate the word conspiracy with theory because, after all, there's no such thing as a real conspiracy, is there? They're all theories. Well, the active word is theory. Now, a definition of a theory is a supposition, a concept, a hypothesis. Here's an example. In theory, if I purchase a raffle ticket, I could win a prize. Now, as long as I do not purchase a raffle ticket, the win will remain theoretical. But once you purchase a raffle ticket, the win now becomes a possibility. And the more raffle tickets you purchase, the more possible and eventually probable the win becomes. Such is the case with a conspiracy theory. If you have no evidence, then it is a conspiracy theory. But once you have one piece of evidence, the theory becomes a possibility. And the more evidence that you gather, the more possible and eventually probable the conspiracy is. So let's keep this in mind when we examine the video footage, the video evidence, the photographic evidence that is contained in this presentation. Because you will realize very quickly, we are not talking about a conspiracy theory. We're talking about hard evidence that is irrefutable, undeniable, and easily confirmed in any of the magazines that many of you listeners already have. If you've got a coffee table book that has pictures of September 11th and the attacks, look for the picture of the plane just before it hit the South Tower. You've got this photograph. There is something attached to the belly of the plane that should not be there. Now, George Bush did make one statement that I happen to agree completely with, and I think that since we're talking about conspiracy theories and putting them in the context of Condoleezza Rice, who made the statement that they had proof that linked Osama bin Laden and the Taliban to the terrorist attacks on September 11th, and they would release that information in due time. Well, America and the world are still waiting for that information, and in the meantime, we've launched not one, but two wars halfway around the world, killing innocent men, women, and children. So as far as conspiracy theories is concerned, I think that the definition would refer directly to the accusation of Osama bin Laden and the Taliban, and here's George Bush.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Malicious lies that attempt to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves, away from the guilty.
Boy, those words have significant new meaning now, don't they, Dr. Monteith?
They certainly do, and we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Dave Van Kleist, and I think you'll be fascinated as we begin exploring what really happened to the Pentagon on the morning of September 11th, when supposedly a plane, a gigantic plane, made a little tiny hole in the Pentagon. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this morning is Dave Van Kleist, and he's been talking about this idea of a conspiracy theory, and our minds have been conditioned, of course, to repudiate the idea that there could be anything like a conspiracy. People who believe in conspiracies believe in black helicopters. They believe in the fact that somebody besides Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy, and yet history is full of conspiracies. There was a conspiracy to kill Julius Caesar. There was a conspiracy to kill Jesus Christ. The Sadducees and Pharisees conspired against him and trumped up charges and, of course, manipulated the crowd so that Pilate would release Barabbas rather than Christ. And certainly there was a conspiracy behind the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Of course, they don't teach that in our schools any longer, but there were four or five people who were associated with John Wilkes Booth, and they were all ended up being hung. So we know that there have been conspiracies. In fact, Hillary Clinton talked about the vast right-wing conspiracy to get her husband.
Mm-hmm.
If you look and see what has happened time and time again, there have been conspiracies. Certainly the mafia is a conspiracy. We never question that they work together secretly. Why should we question that other things of this sort would happen and that governments would create incidents to justify going to war? In fact, if you read the history of the onset of the Second World War, Adolf Hitler dressed up a number of people in Polish uniforms. There were a number of German prisoners, took them out, shot them. No, I guess they were Germans, actually, and they were in German uniforms, and they said, look, the Poles have killed all these Germans, and that's why we have to go to war. He had to have an excuse to do it, and so they took the prisoners, they put them in German uniforms, and they killed them, and now they had the photographic evidence of the Polish aggression. I mean, it's a story that's been used over and over again, because the average individual, the average citizen, doesn't want to go to war. But, of course, if you read Paul O'Neill's book, The Price of Loyalty, and he was the Secretary of Treasury, he tells you about attending secret cabinet meetings, or at least private cabinet meetings, in the White House in January and February of 2001, 7 to 8 months before the 9/11 attack. And what are they talking about? Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, they're talking about how we're going to be able to get the American people to go to war with Iraq, how we're going to divide up the Iraqi oil, how we're going to justify a preemptive strike. This is 7 to 8 months ahead of time, but I bet you haven't read about that in your other books, but you can get it, The Price of Loyalty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and all of our stations are back with us. Dave, why don't you continue telling the story?
Okay. There's just so much information in such a short amount of time. Now, this issue about conspiracy theory, I wanted to make sure that everybody understands that we do not want, in any way, shape, or form, to go down the road of conspiracy theories on this videotape. I mean, you can speculate and you can come up with hypotheses all you want, but we wanted to stay strictly on the evidence. The video and photographic evidence in this documentary, 911 in Plain Sight. And by the way, the website is www.911inplainsight.
And Dave, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get that video if they want to. Don't give the price, but it's very economical. Ahead and tell them how they can get that video.
Well, they can order online by going to www.911inplainsight.com. And that's plain, P-L-A-N-E. Site, S-I-T-E, 911inplainsight.com, or we've set up a special toll-free line just for this video. The response has been unbelievable. Now, we could market this all day long. This is a professional production. We had to pay tremendous amount of money for releases on video footage. We put a lot of money and time and effort into this project, and we could market this all day long for $24.95 or even $29.95. But what we decided to do is, because of the fact that people would say that we are exploiting other people or trying to profiteer over the tragedy of September 11th, we did not want to go there. So what we've done is we put it out for a donation. Now, we're at a suggested donation would be $15, but that's a suggested donation, and then $5 for the shipping. And you can get a copy by calling 866-773-9469. That's 866-773-9469, available on DVD or VHS.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you get on to the what we saw in the Pentagon? Because
okay,
that's really so fascinating.
It really is. But there's one more piece of information we were just drawing attention to last Friday, and we'd heard about this. But here is a report. And now I want to wrap this up with the planes in New York before we go to the Pentagon and Building 7. Now, some folks are saying, "Now wait a second, Dave. What you're saying here is that the planes that hit the North and South Towers were not commercial aircraft. So if the commercial airliners didn't go there, where did they go?" And again, I reiterate, if you have an unlimited black ops budget, they'll go anywhere you want them to. Now, keep this in mind as I read to you the following news article, and it's posted at our website, 911inplainsight.com. This news article was posted at 11, now this is important, folks, listen to this. This news item was posted at 11:43 a.m. on September 11th, 2001. At 11:43 a.m., posted by Liz Foreman, a staff news reporter from WCPO Television in Cleveland, Ohio. Here's the headline. Plane lands in Cleveland. Bomb feared aboard. A Boeing 767 out of Boston made an emergency landing Tuesday at Cleveland Hopkins International Airport due to concerns that it may have a bomb aboard, said Mayor Michael R. White. White said the plane had been moved to a secure area of the airport and was evacuated. United identified the plane as Flight 93. The airline did say how many people were aboard the flight. United said it also was deeply concerned about another flight, Flight 175, a Boeing 767, which was bound from Boston to Los Angeles. Now, again, this was posted at 11:43 Eastern Standard Time on September 11th of 2001, a full 1 hour and 43 minutes after we were told Flight 93 had crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And, of course, the Flight 175, or what we were told Flight 175, had supposedly crashed into the South Tower at 9:03 Eastern Standard Time. Now, this story we reported on our broadcast last Friday. 2.5 hours later, this post disappeared. Luckily, we did cache the page. But when you go to the website at WCPO Television, it now reads that this story was removed. It was an Associated Press preliminary story, and the information was not factual. So a lot of very strange things are happening. And keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that when the planes took off from Logan Airport and Dulles, they were only tracked by radar for a short period of time, and then they disappeared from radar. That's the big mystery. Nobody seems to know where these planes were for over 30 minutes. That's plenty of time for a plane to land someplace else up in the Northeast and another plane to take off to take its place.
Well, you know, it's amazing. In my latest newsletter, I simply quote from the article in the, I believe, in the New York Times, or no, perhaps in the Wall Street Journal. But apparently, immediately after the tragedy. Why was supervisor at where air traffic control got five of the air traffic control people who had been in touch with those planes together and had them record exactly what happened, because this would be very important. After all, you know, sometimes we forget what happened. So they immediately record this. It's all on a tape. And then that tape, nothing is done with it. It never turned in. In January, why the senior supervisor, and I'm simply quoting the article, crushes the cassette with his hand, takes out the tape, and cuts it into small pieces and puts it into various trash receptacles around the building, because he felt that, well, we're far better off with written reports than with auditory reports. And, of course, the Department of Transportation chastised and said, gee, you shouldn't be destroying evidence like that. That's a bad thing. But, of course, nothing else was done. Now, why would anybody hold the tape for that many months, crush it in their hand, and then cut the tape into small pieces? Why not just throw it away? But cut it into small pieces and put it into various trash receptacles so it could never be reconstituted. Anybody would like to see that article? We have it. We'd be glad to send it out to them. So there are lots of strange stories, aren't there, Dave?
Well, yes, there are. But, again, there's so many of them. You know, there's so much corruption out there. There's so many things that we all know are wrong with this world. And the only way that we can defeat the monsters that are out there and overcome the madness is to try to stay strictly on the evidence, because that's where their Achilles heel is. And if we can't back up what we say, at least have something tangible to base our opinions on, then yes, they can label us as black helicopter conspiracy theorists that receive alien transmissions in the fillings of our teeth, and we can continue down that path from now to the end of time. But the only way we're going to be able to defeat the evil people that have taken over our government is to deal with the evidence, and we can go from there and use logical deduction, but that's as far as we can go. Now, again, there were so many different incongruities and inconsistencies with September 11th. Now we move to what happened at the Pentagon. Now, I have a clip here from a report that was live on CNN, and here is an eyewitness, what he said he saw.
I mean, it was like a cruise missile with wings, went right there and slammed right into the Pentagon. Huge explosion, a great ball of fire, and smoke started billowing out.
Okay, a cruise missile with wings is what one person said. Now, we were told that flight 77, a Boeing 757, slammed into the Pentagon shortly after 9:30 Eastern Time on September 11th. Now, we've all seen the photographs of that gaping hole, how it collapsed. The left side just dropped right down, and the right side was hinged, and it just sort of fell down. And we've all seen that picture. But what most of us are not aware is that that did not occur. That specific collapse did not occur until 35 minutes after whatever happened at the Pentagon. For the first 35 minutes, the firefighters arrived at the scene, they pulled out their hoses, and they sprayed the front of the building down with fire-retardant foam. The very amazing thing is that there was no hole on the front of the Pentagon. Well, there was a small hole, about 16, 18 feet, 20 max. But certainly, a 20-foot hole is not big enough to accommodate a complete 757 airliner.
And, of course, as you have the airliner superimposed upon the picture, and what happened to the wings? What happened to the tail?
Yeah, well, there are some folks out there that are actually trying to make others believe that the wings conveniently folded back and got sucked into the hole behind the fuselage. Ladies and gentlemen, those wings are put on there with what they call shear-off bolts, so that the wings will shear off. That's what they do. So the point here is that the photographs, and then we're not talking one, we're talking numerous photographs, plus video footage from ABC and Fox of the firefighters working the area before the collapse of the Pentagon. Now, there was not only not a hole big enough to accommodate a 757, but there was also no wreckage, at least no recognizable pieces of wreckage. There was some debris in the front of the Pentagon, but, I mean, there were no wings. There was no tail, no fuselage, No wheels, no engines, no luggage, no seats, no passengers. Nothing there that you could recognize as the wreckage from a 757, Boeing 757 airliner. So we have to ask the question, what happened here? If we were to arrive at a crime scene, you don't go into the crime scene saying, okay, this is what happens, this is what happened, let's make the evidence fit our assumption as to what happened. That's not the way you solve a crime. You show up at the crime scene, and you look around and you say, what happened? And then you try to pick up evidence to try to figure out what happened. Well, if we use that particular mindset as an investigator of a crime, and we arrive at the scene at the Pentagon, and you look around you, and you see that there's a 16, 18-foot hole, and there's no wreckage whatsoever that you can see of a 757, and that hole pierced not one, but three rings of the Pentagon, you'd look at the damage and say, what could possibly cause that damage?
And I think that each ring of the Pentagon, what, was about 3 feet of reinforced steel?
Right. The inner and outer walls are each approximately 18 inches of steel-reinforced concrete. So that's exactly right. Each ring represents 3 feet of steel-reinforced concrete. So we're talking about 9 feet of steel-reinforced concrete. Are we to believe that the fuselage of an airliner, which is built very lightweight, are we to believe that this is going to slam through and pierce 9 feet of concrete? I don't think so. However, we'd have to ask the question, what could pierce 9 feet of concrete?
Because it went all the way through and came out in a courtyard.
That is correct. And again, if you're a police investigator searching through a crime scene, trying to figure out what happened, well, you certainly wouldn't come up with the conclusion that it was a 757 airliner when you look at the damage. You'd have to say, well, what could pierce 9 feet of concrete and leave a 16 to 18 foot hole? We've showed these pictures to many of the veterans that we've been in contact with, both Air Force, Special Forces, Navy, and all of them say the same thing. The only thing that they can surmise that the Pentagon was hit with would be something you call a bunker buster, something that's designed to pierce concrete. So, again, we have to look at the photographic evidence. Oh, and then we've got, of course, the actual footage of the collapse of the Pentagon. Now, most people, they see this and they say, wait a second, this seems like everything's backwards here. Well, yes, it does. Because what we were told is that the plane slammed into the Pentagon and it collapsed that area, taking out 50 support columns. And yet, if that's true, how do we explain the actual footage of the collapse? And what happened in the time between the actual attack, what was the attack, and the collapse itself?
Now, you were actually going to get the fire chief who was there spraying the foam onto the Pentagon.
That's right.
And then did somebody tell him not to appear on your program? What was that all about?
Well, I can't say for sure, but I did contact the fire chief of that engine company. His name is James Plower. And I spoke personally with him, and I said, we are so thrilled to have the opportunity to honor you and your comrades in this engine company for your heroism, and I wanted to invite them onto the radio show, and they said fine. And that was the day before we went to go on the air, and the next morning I called them up to confirm at about 45 minutes, about an hour or 45 minutes before airtime, and I spoke to Mr. Plower, and he told me unfortunately the other two firefighters that were going to join him on the air had been placed on indefinite leave, and that he would not be able to join me on the air either. He was very sorry, but maybe we could reschedule. And since then, he's never returned my call.
Well, at first, you can't help but wonder, did somebody get to him? Did somebody not want the American people to hear what happened this morning? Dave, we're almost out of time. I think one thing that is so important is the question of building number 7, which was actually quite a distance away from the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm.
Building 6 was between the Twin Towers and 7, building 11, 7. There was no evidence of any jet fuel or anything getting on that building, and yet suddenly
right.
There are fires in that building. And then, of course, you have a clip with the owner of the building.
Yes, I have it already queued here. And by the way, I do want to mention that we've looked at the actual collapse of the North and South Tower,
and examine them very carefully, because many, many, many of these clips show Building 7. Building 7 was right next door there. And in every single clip, we have tried to see if any major pieces of debris hit Building 7. And in every single case, we could not find anything really slamming into Building 7.
But somehow there got to be fires in the building.
Yes, there were fires in the building. And here's a key statement by Larry Silverstein. He was the lease owner of the Trade Center. And he was interviewed about, seven or eight months ago for a PBS special, and I believe it was called America Rebuilds. Listen carefully to what Mr. Larry Silverstein says in regard to what the decision was made about Building 7.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such a terrible loss of life. And the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull. And we watched the building collapse.
Okay, hold it right there. Now, they said pull it. Question, how do you pull a building? Because pull it is a term used by controlled demolition experts when they want to bring a building down after they have set their charges.
And, of course, the interesting thing is, has anybody in the listening audience ever seen a steel-reinforced building that had a fire in it collapse the way that Building 7 did?
It's never happened before.
Never happened in all history. And yet we see that this did not happen in the upper floors where the fires were. This happened all around the base when the base suddenly collapsed.
That's right.
How could they possibly, why would they blow up that building on the very day of the 911 attack?
It would be impossible to do so, because in order to do a planned demolition, you have to have experts come in. They have to examine the structure of the building, do an analysis. They have to look at the beams, the girders. They figure out which ones are the key points. Then they have to wire all of the explosives in succession. And then when everything is cleared up, then they can, quote-unquote, pull it. Are we to believe that they did all of this work after the attacks, the surprise attacks in New York City? So now we have to ask the question, if they had charges already in place in Building 7, which is indicated by Larry Silverstein's statement, to pull it, how else could you pull it without having detonation charges in there? If there were charges in Building 7, is it possible that they had charges in Building 6, or Building 5, or Building 4, or maybe the North Tower, or the South Tower? It's very strange, because people that have seen the collapses of the North and South Tower all say that it sure does look like a controlled demolition. Well, you know what? There were a couple of firefighters that ran for their lives that said the exact same thing.
We made it at least two blocks, and we started running. Floor by floor, it started popping out.
It was if they had detonated.
All the way down. I was.
Now, I don't know how much more evidence that we need, folks. I know people out there are saying, oh, conspiracy theory. Folks, we have to know what a conspiracy theory is and why it's a theory and why it is a conspiracy. Now, we are talking about evidence here. You're hearing the audio portions of this video presentation that is going all over the country and making a lot of people think very hard about what happened on September 11th. I implore you to get out of the box. I beg you to think outside of the auspices of what the mainstream media tells you. The website is 911inplainsight.com. That's 911inplainsight. That's PLANESITE.com. Visit the website. Take a look at the photos there. And understand that we have got to consider this video footage and what the implications are. And we are begging people to get copies into their local firefighters' hands, police officers' hands. Get it into the local library, your local ma and pa video store, your elected officials, your friends, your neighbors, your co-workers. I am just basically planting the seed. It's up to the listeners to tend the garden. And we ask everybody out there to get a copy of this, or get multiple copies. And if you want to get a case of them, we've got we'll get them to you that way too. You can call 866-773-9469. The number is 866-773-9469. Excuse me, that's 9469. Now, I've been told, and I'd like to get your opinion, Dr. Monteith, I've been told that in some people's opinion that this video is the 2x4 to smack a collective America between the eyes to get their attention. Would you see this video that way?
I think that most people, when they finish seeing this video, sit there in shock, disbelief, and with that horrible feeling that maybe we've been lied to, maybe that what we have been told really isn't true at all. Something happened to those people, and we may never know what happened to the people who were on those planes that morning.
Well, that's right. And we also have to remember that the first tower that was hit by the plane was not televised. That was a surprise attack. The only reason we got to see the video footage is because the Naudet brothers just happened to be on the streets of New York and catch that. But that was not live on television. So if that was not live on television, how do we explain this comment from George Walker Bush?
The first thing that went through your head when you heard that a plane crashed into the bush?
Well, I was sitting in a schoolhouse in Florida. I'd gone down to tell my little brother what to do, and you go ahead, sit down. Just kidding, Jeb. And it's the mother in me. Anyway, I was sitting there, and my chief of staff, well, first of all, when we walked in the classroom, I had seen this plane fly into the first building. There was a TV set on.
How did that happen? How did he see a plane go into the first building? There are so many problems with the story of 9/11 as the official story was fed to the American people, and now we have a chance to find out what really happened.
And of course, the thing is that those films weren't available, I think, for many, many hours after that.
That is correct.
All right, today we're out of time. God bless you. Thank you so very much. I think that you've done a very important work. I hope our listeners, all of them, will want to get your video and, of course, show it and contemplate it. And then ask yourself, what's the end result of this? Well, we're in war. We have, of course, the Patriot Act. We have the Office of Homeland Security. We have the Model Health Plan. And, of course, all of these are designed to take away our freedom. Most people are going along with it because they believe we're involved in a war on terrorism. But is it really a war on terrorism? If you read the Patriot Act, there's not one word about Islamic terrorism in it. It is all redefining the meaning of the word terrorist, and we are moving towards a police state. God bless you, Dave. Thank you for everything you've done.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and I simply want to mention that those of you would like to have a good idea of what really happened on that morning, we'll be glad to send you a free copy of my July newsletter. You'll have to specify the July newsletter. There is a smoking gun that was actually in the 911 commission hearings, and the most amazing thing is why nobody on the commission picked up on it, and nobody in the media picked up on it, but it's in the commission hearing, actually, and you'll see it quoted in my newsletter. The other thing is, of course, the story of the magic passports, because read the 911 staff commission report. Just before the North Tower collapsed, somebody's walking along the sidewalk there in New York. They see a passport on the sidewalk. They pick it up. They give it to a New York City police officer or police detective. And it's the passport of one of the terrorists who was on the plane that hit the North Tower. Now, I want you to imagine, here's this plane, it crashes into the North Tower. There's an explosion. And somehow the passport gets out of the terrorist pocket, is able to get out of the flaming wreckage there in the North Tower, is able to get out of the flaming North Tower. The only thing that escapes from that building is the terrorist passport. Do you honestly believe that story? Because could it really have happened that way? Because if it didn't happen that way, somebody knew who was supposed to be on that plane and forged the passport and planted that on the sidewalk. Now, the chances of this happening by accident, what, 1 in 1 billion? 1 in 10 billion? But exactly the same thing happened. There was another passport that was found at the site in Pennsylvania. What are the chances the two passports would survive? Because if they didn't survive, ladies and gentlemen, why, we haven't been told the truth. If you'd like a copy of my July newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, may God have mercy on America. Until tomorrow at the same time, we'll be back again. May the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Rage at Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, we're going to be talking about something that deals with California here for the next hour, but believe me, what happens in California will influence all of the rest of the nation, because California is sort of a bellwether state. We have 10% of the population of the entire nation here in the state of California. We're certainly one of the largest, if not the largest state in the union. And California, of course, as you recall, it was just a little over a year ago, where we impeached our governor because he had a budget of some, I think, $93 billion that had increased tremendously over the previous year, and the governor had insisted there was not going to be a massive deficit. And then once he was reelected, this is Governor Gray Davis, why we found out he had lied to us, and he had lied to us about so many things. His administration had gone along with the energy crisis, which was a scam, of course, to create a crisis and drive up the price of electricity. And Gray Davis was a pretty unscrupulous sort of a politician. He's the sort of individual who gives politics a bad name. Well, we were going to have a recall election, and just at the last minute, when it looked like we might really get an honest-to-goodness conservative American into office here and as governor of the state of California, why, suddenly Arnold Schwarzenegger, the famous movie star from Austria, where his father was a member of the Nazi Party, Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to run for the governor. Now, before he does that, he is actually taken to Europe by Warren Buffett and introduced to Lord Rothschild, gets his blessing, comes back here, and if you doubt this, it's up on Infowars.com, and I've seen pictures of the three of them together, smiling and laughing, Warren Buffett, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Lord Rothschild, sort of like the cat that's just eaten the canary. And, of course, then George Shultz, who's part of the CFR complex, is on the committee along with Warren Buffett to get Arnold Schwarzenegger to become our governor. And what does Arnold do? Why, his first budget, a cost-cutting budget, is $103 billion. Of course, he had to borrow $15 billion last year, and he's going to have to borrow another $6 billion this year, hoping, of course, that we will get the income enough so that we won't have to borrow even more. And what we're doing is hawking our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren so that Arnold can continue spending and spending. But he's a Republican, and that's all right when Republicans do this sort of thing. But it's not simply the spending, the excessive spending. He has a program to redo education here in California. And not only to redo education, he wants the children, when they're 3 and 4, to be brought under the state control. We want, of course, to help these little children so that they can do better by the time they're 6. No, they want to get them out of the home, out of the relationship with their parents. They want to begin indoctrinating them in internationalism and in environmentalism and begin to change their psyche, because they know the earlier they can get their hands onto the child, the sooner they can begin to remold his reality. And a massive new spending program. Well, I'm going to let Karen Holgate tell us about this, because she is with Capital Resources up in Sacramento, and of course is instrumental in trying to inform people all across the state of California about the wonderful program our conservative Republican governor is bringing to our state. Karen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, and I do want to say I'm now with California Family Council, which is closely associated with Focus on the Family.
Okay, fine.
All right, just want to clarify that. Okay. When we move around from different organizations, what can you say?
Well, of course, Capital Resources used to be associated with Focus on the Family, too. So.
Yes, but they are no longer.
Oh, I see. Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, what's going on, and quite frankly, we don't know yet where the governor stands on this. It's called the Master Plan for Education. And what happened is that Senator Dede Alpert, 4 years ago, formed a task force for 2 years, and they studied ways to supposedly bring children into school better prepared to learn. So what we're going to do is we're going to create this statewide school readiness system.
Like a Head Start program.
Yeah, exactly. And so what they did, they studied it for 2 years. The task force came out with their report at the end of 2002. So at the beginning of 2003, the brand new legislative session that's just ending in 2 weeks, they introduced about 5 or 6 or 7 bills, all dealing with this master plan for education. Now, most people, when they think of education, think of kindergarten through 12th grade and then maybe college. But you see, to our legislators, that's not always the way they think. They think, you know, it starts at birth. And so what they want to do in this new plan is create, under the Department of Education, a universal education system, basically, where the Department of Education would set standards for children as young as birth, so that they have this seamless, as we called it, a seamless web all the way from birth all the way till they graduate.
It's sort of like a spider spins, I think, more like that.
Exactly.
Sort of a web.
Exactly.
That to entrap our children and, well, you know, what spiders do to flies.
Exactly, and it looks very enticing. So specifically what's going to happen, they want to start out with what they call a voluntary universal preschool system. And I know that you have a lot of listeners, Dr. Stan, that are not residents of California, but I want them to understand that what we're going through here is already happening in some states, and there is a national drive to have universal preschool throughout the United States, and initially to have it start out as voluntary, and then, you know, gradually we'll just say, gee, it's just so great, we need to have all kids 3 and 4 years old into this preschool system. So we're going to start out in California with these bills, if they pass, a voluntary universal preschool system with access for all 3 and 4 year old children. Now, it will be mandatory for every school district in the state to make sure that they have these preschool systems. So there is already a certain mandate with that.
But, of course, the average school system is having real trouble even paying for what they already have. Where are they going to get the money for that?
Well, exactly. But it gets worse. Then what it's also going to do is we want to have child care available for everybody, no matter if they're rich, poor, whatever. We want to have state government-sponsored and taxpayer-funded child care available from birth through age 3. Now, what they are going to do in this 0 to 3 age category is they want to have full health screenings, including physical, mental health screening and monitoring. We're going to have parental training so that parents best know how to raise their children, of course, for school readiness. Of course, then we're going to have to provide new facilities and equipment and transportation to get them there. We're going to have what we're calling discriminatory recruitment of teachers and workers, because the plan says that we have to make sure that we have teachers who are culturally relevant and, you know, are a part of the children that they teach. So, I mean, so I guess, you know, if you're Oriental, you can't teach a white child. I mean, does this make sense? You know, if you're a teacher, you're a teacher. So, and then data collection, it just goes on and on. But that's just a section of the bill.
But don't you think, really, they want the teacher to replace the parent as the authority figure?
Oh, of course they do. In fact, the plan, I was looking for it just when the phone rang, so I could give you the exact quote, but there is a part in the plan where it talks about, they're talking about at-risk kids and low-income kids where they're going to start this. And they say the problem is that a lot of these low-income parents don't take their children to child care. they leave them with a close family or close family friend or to, with a family member. And those children just don't do as well as the children that were in the institutionalized child care.
Oh, I don't believe that for one minute.
Well, I don't either. These are the conclusions that they draw.
But they come up with preconceived conclusions to justify their program, because what they really want to do is get that child away from the parent.
Well, of course. And, in fact, one of the bills actually starts out saying educational opportunities must be provided during early childhood and must not be delayed until a child reaches 5 or 6.
You know, what people really need to do is go back and read Plato's Republic, because this really, this whole idea comes out of Plato's writing, where, of course, they wanted, of course, to destroy the family and all children would belong to the state. That was what he stipulated, writing almost 2,350 years ago. This was the long-range plan. And this plan, the idea that Plato wrote about, with a ruling elite and, of course, then a massive military to control the people, and then, of course, all women belonging to all men, and then the children belonging to the state, that is what they're implementing today. Always in the name of, oh, we're here to help the child, or success by six, or some similar slogan. But that's not what it's about. It's about controlling the mind and heart and soul of our children, because they have a different agenda. They have a different worldview. And I think this is one of the worst things I've ever heard.
Well, it is for me, too. And we've talked about a lot of pretty bad things on the air. But this is really... It's scary in its implication, because I've said in through conference hearings. Well, let me back up a minute. Let me tell you how these bills have gone through the process, which is just appalling. And I know it doesn't happen just here in California. This is part of the legislative process. I've seen it back in Congress. The bills were introduced, as I said, at the beginning of 2003, and they had all this language in them, so we were able to track the intent of the bills and what they were going to do. Then they get scheduled for a policy hearing, because in the way the legislature works is a bill gets drafted, it gets assigned to a policy committee, and then if there's costs attached, it also goes to an appropriations committee, then it goes to the floor of that house for a vote, and then it goes over to the other house and goes through the whole process again. So just as these bills reached the first policy committee, all the language was stripped away from the bills, all of them. They were just gutted. And instead, there was a one-paragraph intent language added that was pretty much the same throughout all the bills. And what happened is the bills went through the first policy committee. They passed. Nobody knew what they were going to do, but they passed on a one-paragraph. Then they go to fiscal appropriations. And we're talking about billions and billions of new taxpayer dollars. They pass their appropriations with nothing more than this intent language. Then it goes to the other house.
But did it tell them how many billions of dollars are going to be involved?
No.
They're just sort of like a blank check.
Just kind of like a blank check. The only analysis that we have seen of these bills was on one of the bills early on, AB 56. And just to talk about the cost for a minute, that analysis was saying just for the preschool portion of this, that it would cost $3,600 per pupil for a 180-day program. Now, Texas is considering implementing universal preschool. They are estimating the cost at $10,000 per pupil. The Packard Foundation, which is very supportive of universal preschool, says the cost could range anywhere between $6,000 and $12,000 per
pupil.
You're
not suggesting that they're lying to our legislators.
Yeah. The thing is, nobody knows. They have no clue, and especially when you're talking about not just preschool, you're talking about beginning at birth with all these mental and physical health screenings and the training for the parents. And then they want to, what I didn't mention, is they also want to, right now in California, we have kindergarten is a voluntary thing. Most parents don't know that, but we do not have to send our children to kindergarten. Most parents do. 91 to 95% of all 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds go to kindergarten, but they don't have to. And if the parents want to keep them home, there's no hassle. Under this bill, they want to force all children age 5 into mandatory kindergarten full day. They want to extend the day to the same length of time as first, second, third graders attend. Now, you've got to say, what on earth is wrong with these people?
No, Karen, there's nothing wrong with them. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the parents to know.
They have any control.
Right.
I know. So anyway, all this is going on. They don't know how much. They go all the way through both houses with this intent language, and they finally get to, 2 weeks ago, they went into a conference committee where 6 members, 3 on each house, are going to draft the language for these bills. A week and a half ago was the first time I heard them discussing how much it's going to cost. Where are we going to house these people? How are we going to put them into buildings? Let's see, do we have enough facilities? What about teachers? Are we going to have enough teachers? And then somebody finally asked Dee Dee Alpert, who was the chairman of the conference committee, how much is this going to cost? I thought I'd never hear that word. You know what she said? She said, well, we'll leave that up to the governor's office, and then we'll just have to go to the taxpayers and get it. That's their cavalier attitude.
That
about
is,
how they're going to fund their liberal ideas.
This is the way the feudal lords look upon it. We just go to the common serfs and we make them pay for our programs because we know what's best.
That's right. And that's what they're doing. And I mean, Californians are so heavily taxed now. We pay one of the highest tax rates in the nation. And people, I'm telling you, it's not just going to be California. It's Oklahoma already has a program. North Carolina already has a program. Georgia has a program.
Well, what's it costing in those states? Do we have any idea?
Well, they only break it down like by the billions, but they're up in the billions, and those are all much smaller,
much smaller states
than we are.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, it's going to be multi-billions.
Now, well, of course, how effective is the program in making the child really able to learn so much better when they get into kindergarten and the first several grades?
Well, see, that's what I love. You sit in on these hearings, and they scratch each other's back, and they pat each other, and they tell them what a great job they're doing and how we're going to do this wonderful thing for the children, right? We're going to help the parents.
Well, everything is for the children. Have you ever noticed how everything is for the children?
That's right. So what they do is they start citing Head Start. They start citing the Georgia program, the Oklahoma, the North Carolina, and a 1960s program that was called the Perry Project. And let's go through these one at a time just so people understand. Here's the truth, folks. Head Start started in 1965. By the year 1997, 17 million children had gone through the program at a cost to the federal government of $44 billion.
That's B, billion dollars.
B, with a B. What happened is, in 1997, the General Accounting Office for the federal government did a report, and they said, the body of research on current Head Start is insufficient to draw any conclusions about the impact of the national program. And in 1985, the Department of Health and Human Services, and let me back up again a minute here. What they say is that children who've gone through Head Start, children who've gone through these other states' preschool programs, enter school much better and ready to learn. They know their numbers, they know their alphabets, blah, blah. They're more socially, acclimated, et cetera. And then they say, they do much better throughout school. What we have found is that by the end of second grade, any differences are completely dissipated, and anybody that didn't go to the programs are at a level with them.
Well, I think that this is simply another scheme going along with this idea that they want our children. They want to control them. They want to educate them. But the major thing is they want to get them out of the influence of the parent, who probably believes in patriotism and America and God and family. And of course, our children are not to be brought up that way. They're brought up differently. They're to be, of course, willing to go along with the new plans for the New World Order. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is, this evening is Karen Holgate, and we have Will calling us from Missouri. Hi, Will, did you have a question?
Well, I have. have a question and I have a comment also. First of all, Dr. Stan, great broadcast as usual. But we have this same sort of an insinuation into our school systems here in Southwest Missouri, in that they've already run these trial balloons in the newspapers, and they are building new schools to accommodate this new influx of the 3 to 5 year old groups, and it's just going to be a travesty, I believe. But the question that I have for you both is, are you aware of a philosopher whose name is August Conte, C-O-N-T-E?
No.
No, I'm really not.
Well, it's not a surprise, because I've been researching it for some time. I have a basic premise, which is this, that legal positivism is waging an all-out war right now against the natural law, or what remains of our natural law rights. And looking up and looking into legal positivism, which come out of reading Roscoe Pound's books, The Ideal Element of Law.
Now, for our listeners who don't know Roscoe Pound, but I think he was a professor at Harvard, go ahead.
Yes, he was, and a very well-respected legal man himself. But August Conte is basically the founder of positivism.
But now, what does that have to do with what we're talking about?
Exactly what we have to do with it. He came up with the idea of the religion of humanity and new Christianity, but he is also the founder and the creator, basically, of social studies, socialism, and the whole social philosophy, and the entire process. If you look in social and start through there in encyclopedias, you'll find this fellow. And so what we have basically is a very unusual mental twist or outlook that has spread throughout all of Western Europe and around the world, and it's all coming out of this particular man's mind, and it's impacting our schools, it's impacting everything that we're doing, and this is right on what we're talking about here, because I don't think there are very many parents that would agree that it's a good idea to take your newborn child and hand it to the state, would you?
Nope.
I don't think there is. But if you twist the social system around and go through this process of legal positivism, which is basically writing laws that take away all of the rights of man and then introducing that back through to the people, it is an incredibly diabolical system, and I would encourage anyone to look at it. And if there's anybody out there that knows anything more about it, I'd sure like to hear it on a broadcast.
Okay, fine. Well, thank you so very much for calling, Will. And, of course, there are all these crazy ideas that they have, Karen, that really are aimed at getting our children away from the parents and indoctrinating them in the ideas that the state would have them believe. Isn't that really true? Do you really believe that this is aimed at teaching them how to read and write earlier? In fact, it used to be. For years, they wouldn't allow teachers to begin to teach children the alphabet or teaching them how to read until they were in the second or third grade. And now they're suddenly saying, oh, we were wrong. No, children should be able to read in kindergarten, and they've been held back, and now they want to get to them earlier. Almost looks like they're using this as an excuse to justify really getting the children away from the parents.
Well, yeah, and, you know, the caller just made a valid point where he was talking about most parents, you know, don't want to do that. In fact, in 1998...
Hold that thought right there for just a moment, and we'll bring our other stations on board. Okay, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Karen Holgate, and of course we're talking about this plan to get the children out of the homes in the 3 or 4 and get them under the control of the state, where they're going to begin to mold their minds. And of course, it's all going to tell you over here, we just want to help the child so he can read and write earlier. Hey, 5 years ago you were saying it was wrong to try to teach them how to read and write in kindergarten. We're going to hurt their little psyche, and now you're going to do it at 3 or 4. No, that's not the real reason. The real reason is they want to control them. Go ahead.
Well, this 1998 study found that actually almost 80% of the parents would much prefer to be at stay-at-home moms and raise their children given half a chance. So rather than the government keep stepping in saying, we know best, we're the experts on raising children, let's make it easier to leave them.
And then you get the taxes up so high the mother can't afford to stay home.
Exactly. You know, why don't we do things to encourage, do things to strengthen the family, lower the tax rate, make insurance affordable so parents can stay home, one of the parents at least can stay home with their child. Children who are raised with a parent at home are so much better, well-adjusted. They are more emotionally balanced. They do better in school. And I don't care what your economics are or how at risk. When you have mommy at home or daddy at home, the child does better in study after study after study. And they tend, they always ignore those kinds of reports and studies when they're trying to build their case to expand, you know, their programs. And like my husband always says, follow the money. Everybody that is behind these programs are people who work for an organization or an agency that's going to benefit from these programs. So, you know, you can see exactly what's going on here. And it's just so frustrating to me. And if we had more parents, you know, calling in, telling them, look, stop this foolishness. We're not going to pay for it, and we're not going to put you back in office if you keep pushing this stuff. Because let's face it, a legislator wants nothing more than to stay in power. And unless we start getting involved, we're going to have this kind of stuff jammed down our throats.
I think you're absolutely right, Karen. And the trouble is that the average individual, you know, is so busy being busy, they don't understand the terrible legacy of so much of the legislation that they pass in Sacramento. And we would be far better off if we had the legislator up there for about 2 months out of every other year, a part-time legislature instead of these people who are planning every aspect of our society. But even more frightening, now they want to start getting the children, you know, literally when they first come home, and then, of course, they want to force them because everything is built upon force. Now, you say this is going to be voluntary to begin with, that so is public education, voluntary to begin with, mm-hmm. and before long it's compulsory. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we hear about, you know, voluntary service, you know, before you can get out of high school. But it's really compulsory. They say one thing, they mean another. And until the American people understand that freedom is not free, they're always there, those people who want to control the rest of us. An elite who think that they know far better off what's better for us, and they have a different vision of the world. And it certainly is not the sort of vision of the world that I grew up in, where men were free. It's a vision of a world where everything is controlled and regulated and regimented from above. So how are we going to block this?
Well, what we need to do is we need to have people start calling their own legislator if you live in California. Start calling your assembly member, your senator, and telling them to vote no on the master plan for education bills, and then we need to start calling the governor.
Can you tell me how has the legislation been passed so far? Did our certain Maldonado, who represents this area as an assemblyman, did he vote in favor of the master plan, do you know, the Republican?
Well, they hasn't gone to the floor yet for a vote. The master plan hasn't. The bill's passed with just intent language. So what they're doing now in the conference committee is drafting all the final language. So what they're going to do, they're going to come out next week, like Tuesday or Wednesday, and then they're going to give them to the floor for a vote. They have to vote in session by the 31st, so they're going to have less than 5 days to look at these bills.
In other words, the whole thing is to surreptitiously slip them through
exactly.
So nobody can read them and nobody can object to them. And, of course, they're not interested in representative government. They're really interested in control from the top. Would that be a fair appraisal?
I think that's pretty much true.
We're going to be back here in just a moment with Karen Holgate. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Archie Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Karen Holgate. We're talking about the new master plan for education. Now, I think we have one advantage, and that is that the elections are coming up. And the one thing that, of course, our elected representatives fear is the fact that the people are going to find out how they vote. And I think that you would have a very good reason to be calling your local assemblyman and your local senator here in the state of California, if you live here, and let them know how you feel about the master plan for education, and let them know that if they vote for it, you're going to do everything to make sure that they're not reelected, whether they're Republican or a Democrat.
You know, that is right. And also, no matter what state you're in, if you go to our website at californiafamily.org, we talk about the master plan for education, but we also have a report up on universal preschool. Does it really help children? Is it worth the cost? And that, no matter what state you're in, it will give you some good information on the effectiveness, supposedly, of universal preschool. And we started earlier, Dr. Stan, to talk about the programs that the advocates for these programs use, or the surveys that they look at. And I think it's important for us, because if you are sitting in an audience and you're listening to all the proponents of these programs, they make it sound wonderful. And anybody who would vote against them or voice any opposition, why, you're just out to destroy the children. You don't want them to learn. You don't care about them. I mean, look at all these wonderful results, and we're citing all these statistics and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What they don't ever do is talk about other studies on those same projects that do not reflect what they want you to know.
And, Chris, the thing is that they have all these things all prepared ahead of time.
Of course.
They have it's called sophistry. Argue a false point to the point where people come to believe it's true. And, of course, you've just got to point out that this is illogical. And, of course, there are just as many studies on the other side. But you have to have that information. That's why you'd want to certainly go to Karen's website. And what's that website again?
CaliforniaFamily.org.
CaliforniaFamily.org. Huh?
Right. And in fact, I have a new paper I'm going to probably be posting probably tomorrow or the next day. And let's go through some of these. So you have some information, because it's important for you to know the other side when somebody starts telling you about this. Or even if it's in your state, you go to a legislator, because I'm going to tell you, the legislators don't have time to do this kind of research. And many of them vote for these programs because they have been duped. I mean, a lot of them, if they knew the truth, would not be voting for these. So a lot of...
Hold that thought right there, Karen. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Karen Holgate, and of course you really want to go to their website, which is californiafamily.org. That's californiafamily.org. And get the information, because there are many studies that show that all of this Head Start foolishness and all of this getting the children in and spending countless billions of dollars to get them in at age 3 or even earlier into government control really doesn't do a bit of good. And by the time they get through the second grade, they're no better off, at least as far as academically, and I suspect that mostly they're a lot worse off. Well, right now, before we go on, let's go to Jeannie, who's calling about emotional testing in California. Jeannie, are you there?
Yeah, it's nice to hear Karen again. I haven't heard her in a long time.
Oh, thank you.
They have an interactive software program that's being tested, pilot testing in 5 states. And one of them is California, I believe is Texas and North Carolina. But these people have created this software. It's for grades 3 through the 12th grade. And you can actually go on the website, and they are located, these creators of the software, in Boulder Creek in Santa Cruz Mountains in California.
Right here in our own backyard. Huh?
Yeah. And the website, it's very important to go to this one, and it's www.heart.math.com. And they have what they call a freeze.
I don't like the name already.
Yeah. Well, that's what they're going towards, Karen, is they have interactive software, but the person is connected to a finger sensor that monitors heart rate. And so they test the assessment of the students of how they react to certain questions. And they say on the website that will increase the students' test scores, but also improve their behaviors both in the classroom and at home. And so now they're doing the pilot testing. And I have one of the books that came with one of the CDs that they give out. And they actually say that you will become a co-creator of the life you were born to live.
And that sounds like comes right out of the very pit of hell. It's the whole new age, occultic concepts that they're indoctrinated. Where are they going to be using this, Jeannie, in our schools or where?
It's a pilot program, and I haven't really solidified what schools, but I believe one of the schools is in Boulder Creek, California,
where the headquarters are. You get that information, let us know, because I think that they're using our schools for experimental programs. Do we really want to teach our children the occult in our grammar schools?
Well, and you know what? Another thing, this is so important, because it all plays into, it's all this hocus-pocus, like you said, new age, touchy-feely good stuff. You know, we've talked about this for years, Dr. Stan. And another warning, well, it's a little off subject, but I want to warn people. I just spoke in a church over the weekend, and I had a parent come up to me afterwards. And remember a couple of years ago when we were talking about compacts between the school and the parent's contract?
Right.
Well, she had been sent home for this year, her child's compact.
Contract, isn't it?
Yeah, they call it compacts, but it's a contract.
Okay.
Same word. Means the same thing, I should say. Anyway, the last little thing on here said that by signing this piece of paper, the parent was giving the school permission to allow a teacher or a representative to school to come into their home and monitor their home at any time without prior notice.
I hope that woman didn't sign it.
Well, that's what I said. And she said, well, she scratched that out and initialed it and then sent the rest of it back in.
Well, she never should have signed it.
She should have not have signed anything. And that's why I wanted, because it, what Jeannie was talking about brought this to my mind. Parents, if you get any compacts or any contracts, however they want to call it, that sent home to you by the school, do not send it. And they are not your partner in raising your child. You are your child's parent. They are there to educate your children academically.
And my
friends, don't give them any other permission to do anything.
If you really care about your children, in my estimation, get them out of the government schools. Right. Anything else, Jeannie?
No, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Let's
Jeannie.
Go to Roger, who's calling from Allentown. Hi, Roger. Roger, are you there? Well, I guess we lost Roger. Hello, is this Roger?
Yes, thanks.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, now was that, before I give out the toll-free to the federal Capitol Hill switchboard, was that partly federal or just all California?
No, this is all California.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to give that out anyway. And your last week's guest, Jane Schindler, I think it was bill number, federal bill H.R. 4799, the macabre icing on the death ed cake. At the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
And was that H.R. 4799?
Can't tell you, Roger.
No. Yeah. Anyway, the toll-free is 877-762-8762.
All right, fine.
And God bless you.
Thank you so very much. Good night, Roger, and thank you. Bye-bye. And we've got Mike calling from... hi, Mike. How are you?
Hi there.
Have a question on the subject we're talking about?
Well, clarification. The children have always been referred to as the greatest natural resource of the government. Arnold Schwarzenegger recently, I don't know in what venue, what context, but he said that he would look forward to becoming president of the world someday.
I don't know, perhaps he did say that, but I do know that he does have a master plan for education here, and they're planning on bringing all control of education in California really under the sort of an education czar. Have you looked into that at all, Karen?
Well, yes, I have. In fact, now, I will say there are two things going on here. There's the master plan for education, and then there's the governor's California performance report. And that's the other portion of this. In fact, that's why we're hoping to be able to get the governor to veto the master plan for education, because it contradicts a lot of the California performance review. For instance, just on cost alone, here the master plan, like I said, wants to require all five-year-olds. They want to extend the day of kindergarten. What we call the CPR, the California Performance Review, actually recommends just the opposite. Right now in California, a child whose birthday occurs at age 5 on December 1st can start kindergarten on September. Well, what the CPR wants to do is move that date back to September 1st, so it would allow fewer children to enter kindergarten and would make them older when they do go in, because they say children perform better when they're older. Gee, isn't that amazing? And then they also say that if we just move that date back 3 months, it would save the taxpayers of this state $690 million every year for that 3 month delay. Imagine that.
All right. Well, let's see if Mike has anything else to say. Mike, did you have any other points you wanted to make?
Yeah, I have some unimpeachable facts. The United States ceased to legally exist according to Black's Law Dictionary.
Okay, but Mike, I don't want to get off into that. That has nothing to do with our subject tonight. So we're really trying to stick pretty well with the education and, of course, with that sort of thing. And so go ahead and pick up the story there, Karen.
Well, on the CPR?
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay. So what we're trying to do, just so the people in California know, is what we're trying to do is point out the differences between what the governor wants to do in alignment in his plan and what the master plan, and that they are at odds several places. So there are many, many points in the California Performance Review that we disagree with. But what we're hoping is that he will veto the master plan in the next, 30 days, and then we can go at him on the California Performance Review, but at least it gives us some time. And so that's where we're starting. And this governor, we know that he favors before school and after school programs. We don't know exactly where he stands on all this preschool stuff yet. I would think that he would tend to favor it, but we do know that he is trying to cut some costs.
Well, he's never going to be the President of the United States, and he's really being set up to run for the presidency. There's an invisible force behind him. They've already introduced legislation to amend the Constitution, so Arnold Schwarzenegger can run for president. And people may think that's crazy talk, but there are powerful, powerful forces behind Arnold Schwarzenegger. And so, but of course, he's never going to be able to run for the presidency or for any other major political office if he's not a great success here in California. So far, he's been, in my estimation, a total failure, having put in $10 billion more in his budget this year than Gray Davis had last year, and we impeached Gray Davis.
Well, and let me tell you something else. In both the Master Plan for Education and the California Performance Review, there are provisions for our hated term, school to work.
Right.
And what they want to do is require all students to have the work experiences. They want to align our academics with, the workforce requirements and all of those things that we have been fighting for years, and they are in both of these plans, folks. So any of you who are, we don't have time tonight. For those of you who aren't familiar with School to Work, we'll do that another night. But for those of you who are, be aware that School to Work is going to be back on the forefront next year, because we're going to have this battle in both of these plans.
Well, now, I think it's important that people understand the whole idea, and Arnold has said this, and this educational plan would be work with corporations to begin training people for the jobs that the corporations will have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is basically working for the corporate state.
Mm-hmm.
This is what it's really all about, ladies and gentlemen. They tried this in the 1930s in Italy. They called it fascism. Corporate state or corporate socialism, and that's exactly what Arnold Schwarzenegger is advocating. That's what this master plan, his master plan, is not the master plan that Karen is talking about, but it is his other plan, and that is, of course, we'll train our children. If your son wants to be a doctor, he's not going to be a doctor because there may not be a need for doctors in California at that time. They may want to be a computer analyst. Well, we may not need any computer analysts, so they will not train them and give them the education they need to do that. And the only way you're going to be able to protect your child from this corporate concept, this corporate government or socialist or call it what you will concept, is to get your child out of the state schools. Because when they go to the state schools, believe me, there's no free lunch. You get exactly what you pay for, and you don't pay for it at all. It all comes out of government money. Of course, it's what they take away from us. But once they have the government is running the whole situation, why, of course, your child will be trained for the job they want them to have.
And you are exactly right. And a large part of our problem with school to work is, you know, it started big time under Clinton and Hillary, and this was really her big drive. And what they did is they used the model that they use in Germany right now. And I sat in on a school to work training session for California teachers. There were 900 of them in San Diego a few years ago. And there was a woman that they brought over from Germany to give this workshop. So I made sure I was in her workshop. And I mean, she did the diagrams and she drew all this stuff up on the wall and was telling us how they go, the kids start out and learn and how they branch off into their workforce training. And the only difference in Germany and our plan is that they do educate their kids academically at the lower grades. I mean, those kids learn. But then they have to be, and the reason they do it is because they want to see where their aptitudes are and what job they need to fill over here, so they'll pull that kid and put the kid on that training program and slot. I mean, they are, from the earliest stages, those kids are programmed into their career pathway. And she went through this whole thing and bragging about it. At the very end, she said, you know, the only problem we have with this is that we haven't figured out a way to give the kids or our citizens a choice.
And, of course, they really don't want to give them a choice. They want the state to control everything. Isn't that what it's about?
That's right. And stop and think, choice. They're talking about freedom. And here we have freedom, supposedly, and we're hell bent on getting us to a point where we don't have choice and we don't have that freedom. And that's one of my biggest complaints with school to work, is when they, or the Goals 2000 dumbing down curriculum, was because there are no choices. They want to make it a mandate, and the school to work program actually says that they want to train children to fill the jobs of the local community. And so you were right on, Dr. Stan, when you said, you know, if you want to be a doctor, well, if they don't need any doctors in that community right now, you're not going to be, you know, put on a training path for any that job.
And that's the most incredible thing. Well, we've got Jeff calling from Minnesota. That's up in the heart of the socialist country. But there is a reaction up there, and there's some really good people working in the educational framework trying to turn back the tide. Hi, Jeff. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I was wondering if the funding for the programs is from property or income taxes.
Okay, where would the funding come from? Do we have any idea?
Yeah, they're talking about bonds and they're talking about taxes too. And like I said, they're kind of vague. They don't know where it's going to come from. I do know that our superintendent of public instruction came over during one of the hearings to say that he did not want them to take any of the what we call Prop 98 funds from K through 12. In California, we passed a proposition that guaranteed money and a percentage increase every year for K through 12. And so what he was not saying, I'm against preschool or the child care. I just want to make sure my money is protected over here. In other words, you're going to have to raise additional funds. And remember, Senator Alpert said, we'll just have to go to the taxpayers for it.
Well, let's hope that the taxpayers in California are going to be smart enough not to go for it. And if we're having the contraction in the economy I think we're going to have next year, I think there's going to be a lot of opposition to that. And so anything else you want to ask, Jeff?
I would say that because government exists as a corporate trust system, those who violate the best interests of the trustees, the taxpayers, can and should be held accountable through breach of the public trust.
Well, I'll tell you what, I was just reading something today where a man named Troficant, Congressman Troficant, got up before Congress, and it was 1993, and said, we're bankrupt. The United States is bankrupt. Well, what was the result? Did they address that? No, the FBI set up a sting operation, infiltrated his office, got people working for him, and he's in prison today as a result of an FBI sting. So, you have to understand that nobody is doing get up and speak against the all-powerful state and the bankruptcy they're leading us into.
You understand the truth of the matter is the United States has been bankrupted since 1928, but more importantly is that one must organize themselves locally, as I have begun to do. And I went to the county treasurer and I asked him, where is all the funding? What is the origin of the bond funds? And he said, well, it's everyone's recorded property deed. Those are placed into commerce, and they are used in commerce for the issuance of municipal bond funds and et cetera to fund the various community projects.
Maybe we ought to get our property patented. We wouldn't have to worry about it.
And so I asked, is there informed consent? Where does anyone understand these things? And he couldn't answer that.
Well, the average individual doesn't understand, Jeff, that they're spending itself into oblivion. And this country is really on the edge of a financial precipice. We're just out of time. But thanks very much. I agree with you. We need to get people to be, again, wondering, where is the money coming from? Because government has no money. The only money it has is what it takes from us by force, what it can borrow from future generations and pay interest on, or, of course, at least the federal government can print money, but that leads to inflation. So they're in a very, very difficult situation, and I think that what Karen Holgate is suggesting is maybe we could get Arnold to veto this master plan for education if it does pass the legislature, and it probably will. But we could get him to veto it simply on the point of fiscal responsibility. Is that your thought, Karen?
That is right now. With this governor, I think that's our best bet, and there is a chance he might do that. And I want to go back to this whole thing on bonds and stuff. You know, in California, we used to have a pretty high threshold before we could pass a school bond, and we had a ballot initiative, and the people actually voted to lower that bond threshold. Now it just takes a simple majority, and that's one reason we are getting bonds passed and astronomically.
You can thank Senator McPherson from our area, who pushed that legislation through by saying, well, we need more money for the children. It's always for the children.
Yeah, see, and I mean, this was a huge mistake. And then, of course, Bass Consellas this year, who is a senator in California, tried to get the vote lowered to 14 or 16-year-olds. Can't you see them setting up polling booths on the school grounds and then indoctrinating the kids and then taking them out to vote for school bonds or any other kind of bonds they want?
And then let's let all the illegal aliens vote as well.
Oh, yeah, they're trying to do that in San Francisco.
We live in a world gone mad, and there's only a few of us who are sane. And, our job, though, is to reach more people, and we are reaching more people. And all across America, at least, people, Karen, are hearing what you have to say. And certainly our audience here in the Monterey Bay area understands, I think, what's going on. At least I hope that they do, and I hope that they share your concern, whether they be liberal or conservative. We're not helping the children by taking them away from the parent, because God gave children to parents, not to the state. And we certainly don't want the utopia that Plato wrote about 2,350 years ago in his Republic, which is, of course, the template for everything going on today. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
Just if you live in California, let your legislators and the governor know how you feel about the master plan. And if you're in other states and you've got this plan, you're going to have to fight it because it's coming soon if you don't have it.
All right, fine. And, of course, then the website is californiafamily.org. Is that right?
That's right.
God bless. Thank you so much.
God bless. Good night.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Karen Holgate, and I hope you enjoyed, and we'll be having Karen on more frequently. She's certainly one of my favorite guests, and certainly on the front lines of this incredible battle that's being fought here in California. But this is going to affect every one of you out across America, because there is a master plan, There is a master plan to take away your children and turn them against you and against America and get them to embrace this idea of world government. And all you need to do is talk to these children about global warming. And they have an entirely different view because they've been programmed. Their minds have been programmed. These children, a lot of them can't read very well, and they can't write very well, they can't spell very well. They really don't know mathematics, but boy, they sure know an awful lot about sex. You know, we're concerned about pornography on the Internet. Maybe we ought to be concerned about pornography in the classroom and the sex education that they have woven into all of the various things, and the death education and the suicide education and the values clarification education and all the things that are not preparing our children for a normal, healthy life, but, of course, preparing them for the new age existence that lies ahead, unless, of course, there are enough people out there who really care. So if you really are concerned about your children, if you're concerned what's happening, we hope that you will stay tuned, get the information. We have some wonderful books. One of them is entitled Fed Ed. That's Fed Ed. And, of course, we have a four-tape set that goes with that to tell you about the No Child Left Behind program, which is basically Ted Kennedy's program, which our conservative Christian president, George W. Bush, got through. Why would he put through Ted Kennedy's program, Hillary Clinton's program? Well, you'll have to ask him that. Maybe he can explain it. But this is a disaster. You need to get the book Fed Ed, or you need to get the four-tape set on Fed Ed. You need to get, of course, John Stormer's wonderful book, None Dare Call It Education, to understand how they're using education to intentionally dumb down our children. If you have never seen the Robinson Homeschool curriculum, let me recommend it to you. It's outstanding. Professor Robinson actually used this on his own children, Art Robinson, a personal friend of ours, and he raised the children, all six of them, on his own. And, of course, when the two older boys went to college, they went right into the third year of college because they were so far ahead of the other children had gone to the government schools. Most of our children, the first 2 years of college is, this would be equivalent to the last 2 years of high school in any other country. They're deliberately dumbing down our children. It's not happening by accident. It's happening by intent. You need to get Charlotte Isabey's wonderful book, The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, the book by Pamela Hobbs Hoffaker on outcome-based education. You need to get the information, and then you need to help us reach other people with the information they're not going to get from other sources. Now, let me remind you, we are going to be having a program here in the Monterey Bay area. November 6th, it's going to be the Aptos Seascape golf course, and going to be all day long, going to start early in the morning. Lunch is going to be served, and we do hope that many of you, if there's any way you possibly can, will decide you're going to come. You're going to have to call ahead of time, though, and make a reservation. We have to know how many people are going to be there. It's going to be all day long. We think it's going to be a great program, and we've got already people lined up to come in from outside. So you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, make your reservation. If you'd like, of course, to go to our website, it's radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And look at the various items that we have there that, of course, we have on the market just to sort of help us as we reach out 5 hours a day, trying to educate the American people about the true nature of our battle. It's not a right-left, conservative, liberal. It's a spiritual battle for the hearts and minds and souls of our people. So until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.